My guest David Feingold has been studying opium for 20 years. As an anthropologist, he studied the culture of people in Southeast Asia whose lives revolve around opium growth and trade. His research has led him to study the economics and politics of narcotic production and trade. He's made numerous trips to the Golden Triangle, where he spent time with the Shan rebels, who control much of the opium trade, with the villagers who grow poppy crops, and with government officials. In America, he's spoken with numerous elected officials and was a consultant to the House Select Committee on Narcotics Abuse and Control. He's been critical of American policy towards drug trade, which he's found to be ineffective and uninformed. Feingold was the consultant for three films produced by ATV, British Television, on the opium trade. He's now writing a book on opium production, trade, and use in Highland Southeast Asia. Feingold lives in Philadelphia, where he's the director for research and planning at ISHI, the Institute for the Study of Human Issues, which is located at the University City Science Center. He's also the director for the Center of Opium Research. David Feingold, welcome back to Fresh Air. Nice to have
you back. Thanks very much, Terry.
How do you make contact with people who, like the Shan rebels, who operate pretty much underground? How do you make that kind of inside contact so you could do the kind of research you've been embarked on?
Well, working with opium smugglers is a little bit like the joke about the way porcupines make love, very carefully. You don't just sort of wander up into the hills and say, "Hi, I'm here, I want to study the opium trade." Basically, we've been working with the Shans for a very long period of time. Adrian Cowell and I first made contact with various Shan groups in 1964. One of the reasons why we have been able to work with them over time is because, first of all, we're very careful to be very clear about what it is we're doing, who it is we represent, and also because they have seen it in their interest as well as in our interest to be cooperative. This doesn't mean that all groups have been equally cooperative. The Shans see their problem essentially as political. Let me just give a little background to your listeners as to who the Shans are and where they're located. The Golden Triangle is the area in which Burma and Thailand and Laos come together. Now, the Shans are a minority group who are a Thai-speaking group. They are much closer related to the Thais than they are to the Burmese, who are a minority within the Union of Burma. There are several different minority groups within Burma, most of whom have been fighting with the Burmese government. The reason for this is that these were people who were not traditionally under Burmese rule. They came under Burmese rule at the time of British colonialization. When Burma gained its independence in 1948, these various groups, the Shans and the Kachins and the others, agreed to join the Union of Burma on the condition that they would have certain rights. One of the rights guaranteed to them under the Constitution of 1948 was the right of secession from the Union of Burma after 10 years, and also a guarantee of local autonomy. Now, in 1962, General Ne Win seized power in Burma throughout the Constitution, kicked out the elected government of Burma, and also, in passing, killed a number of the Shan leaders. Basically, what has been going on since then is a conflict between the minority groups who want essentially their rights under the 48 Constitution and the central government of Burma. Now, where opium comes in is that opium is the most important economic asset that exists in that area. It's one of a couple. There are also very high-grade rubies that come from that region. There's teak, there's tungsten ore. But opium is the key. And so you have a number of groups who are merely bandits. You have some groups who are both bandits and revolutionaries. And you have others who are primarily, in the sense that a Westerner would understand it, revolutionaries. The key thing, however, is that all of these groups have to depend to some extent on opium. Or, if not on opium, you have people like the Karens who, for religious reasons, refuse to trade in opium, on the goods that opium money buys. And I think later in the program we'll talk a little bit about the importance of opium in the entire economy of that region.
Well, you see the importance of opium and heroin trade as being enormous in scope internationally and locally here in America. Can you just spell out some of the significance for us?
Well, I think to get a clear idea of exactly how big the illicit narcotics business is, beyond just opium, but all illicit drugs, the most recent American intelligence estimates are that the entire illicit drug trade in the United States, that's not internationally, but just in the United States, is $64 billion to $100 billion. Let's just take the more conservative estimate of $64 billion. That's a number we have very, very great difficulty understanding. But to give you an idea, the largest corporation in terms of sales in the United States is Exxon, the oil company. Exxon's sales last year were $103 billion in sales. Now, the next corporation smaller than that was Mobil Oil, with $59 billion in sales. So what you can see is if we took the drug trade in the United States alone, the drug sales, they would come to being the second largest major corporation in the United States. To give you an idea of what this means on a worldwide scale, certainly opium is clearly the number one contributor to the gross national product of Burma, though it doesn't appear in any of the figures because it's an illicit crop. It is equal, it's estimated to be equal to 50% of, cocaine is estimated to be equal to 50% of the entire exports of Peru. Opium is probably the number seventh contributor to the gross national product of Thailand. So you see, you're talking about very, very major products. Now, this raises a very interesting question. When you are, for instance, planning economic development, when you're talking about international balances of trade, if you leave out narcotics from your considerations, you're obviously only playing with half a deck. And the impact of this, particularly in countries in the developing world, is very great.
You were saying when you go to the Southeast Asia to talk with, for instance, the Shan rebels, you tell them, you spell out for them what your goals are and what your agenda is. What are your goals with your research?
Well, what we're talking to the Shans about, or what, in a sense, any anthropologist going to an area, even dealing with far less sensitive things than this, has to do is to spell out to the people with whom you're dealing what are your objectives there. Now, one of the things that we've done with the Shans, and certainly that I tried to do with the Alka people who I studied, who are opium growers, they're not traders, they're growers, was to explain why it was important for people to know about this. In other words, we are very clear. We are not there to gather intelligence. We are not interested in which caravan is taking which particular route and when it will come down. We are not there to gather that kind of information. What we are there to do is to try and understand the economic structure and the political structure that goes into the trade. Now, this is very, very basic research. One of the things that we were surprised to learn is that, in fact, this research had not been done essentially before we undertook it. The Center for Opium Research at Ishii probably does more research on opium, and particularly on the production and trade aspects, than any other institution in the world. Again, this is different from an intelligence-gathering function. That governments worry about. Sometimes they do a good job. Often they do a very bad job because they don't have a context to put it into. But we feel that this is something that you owe it to your informants, to the people that you deal with, to be able to explain this. And quite often they respond very well. This doesn't mean that they immediately trust you. And it requires a great deal of time and a considerable amount of linguistic facility and being willing to sit around in a village for 2 years before you can get the kind of trust that people will give you in order for you to be able to do your work. There's one other thing. I think often people get the impression, you know, when you talk about opium smugglers in Southeast Asia, that what it is like is attempting to contact a drug-dealing network in the United States and study that. Now, there have been, for instance, sociologists who have done studies of drug dealers in the U.S., but quite honestly, in Asia, you're dealing with a very different kind of organizational structure. We don't study the people who deal in the lowlands. We are not studying the person who's selling a kilo of heroin in Bangkok. We're studying people up in the hills who are essentially outside of governmental control. And one of the tests of the inadequacies of the policy is that, in fact, Shan people are seemingly unafraid of enforcement activities. I mean, they have armies. They are off in the jungle. Their caravans are not effectively interdicted, so they're not really terribly worried about that.
I guess one of your premises here, particularly when you were consulting with the U.S. government, is that in order to make intelligent policy decisions that will come close to reaching its goal, you have to know what's really happening in the area where you're trying to restrict the production, or I think I said that incorrectly. In order to get the desired results, you have to know who's producing it and how it's going to affect them if you make certain policies. And I guess you're saying that the government doesn't really know that.
Well, the problem that the Congress became aware of, and this we have to separate the Congress and the executive. The problem that the Congress became aware of, and this was as early as 1975, when Congressman Lester Wolf was chairman of the House Select Committee on Narcotics. In fact, this was even predated the existence of the Select Committee on Narcotics. It was another subcommittee at the time. They became aware that what we were doing wasn't working. And what's more, they became aware that executive department officials were coming in and testifying and that the problem was going to be solved in 2 years, and that, in fact, it wasn't. So they said, all right, what can we find out about what's going on? Again, not in terms of these little specific questions, but what can we find out about the structure? Now, one of the things that the Shans have always been willing to do is to take in anyone who wants to go. They have said to the United States, to the United Nations, look, if you want to come in, whether you're a congressman or whether you're a representative of the State Department or whatever it is, we'll take you into Shan states and you can look around and you can see what the conditions are. You can see that the reason why people grow opium is because they can't afford to grow anything else. And I think if we can just take 1 minute, maybe I can explain a little bit about what the relationship is between poppies and opium and morphine and heroin. Opium itself comes from one particular subspecies of poppy in the region. It's the Papaver somniferum poppy. There's also something called the Bracteatum poppy, but that isn't grown in the region. The process is very different. Now, opium is made up of a number of different what are called alkaloids, the most important of which is morphine. It's the same morphine that you get when you go to the hospital and have an operation. What heroin is diacetylmorphine. In other words, the morphine is extracted from the opium. In Southeast Asia, you're talking about approximately 10% morphine content in opium. And then it is transformed chemically into heroin. And the reason why it's transformed into heroin is because heroin is easier for smugglers to smuggle. In other words, one of the reasons why you ended up with a heroin problem rather than an opium problem is that opium is 10 times more bulky, approximately, than heroin. In other words, it takes 10 tons of opium to make 1 ton of heroin. Now, the poppy is a very, very difficult crop to grow because, first of all, it requires a minimum of 387 man-hours to raise 3.5 pounds, actually 3.6 pounds, of opium. Now, that's very, very high. It's very hard work because you have to cut down the jungle, then you burn it down, then you have to plant, then you have to weed, and then you have to go to each poppy capsule. What happens to a poppy is after the blossoms fall off, there is a capsule, and you have to, by hand, slit that capsule, and you have to do it very carefully. If you cut the capsule too deep, all the opium runs inside, you lose the opium. You cut it too shallow, and you don't get the resin out. And what happens is that the resin seeps out of the poppy capsule. And it's about the consistency of, say, warm wax, not hot wax, not liquid. Then it dries to about the consistency, say, of old chewing gum. And you have to go and scrape that off the next day. So you have tremendously high labor inputs for the people who grow it. The time, for instance, I spent 2 years with the AUCA, a household would receive approximately the equivalent of $50 for a year's worth of labor. We figured out that probably their return was about, oh, somewhere between 30 or 40 cents an hour over a 5-year period. So the growers don't make out very well. The reason why they grow it is because it has a very high value per amount of weight. And these people live off in the jungle. They live up in the mountains. They can't get their crops to market. It's not as if people can, you know, send down their truck farm vegetables or whatever it is. There are no roads here. So what we're dealing with is an area where it's very important for people to be able to have a product that's very high in value per amount of weight because what we call transport costs are very high. Now, in addition to that, opium acts in three ways. It, first of all, is a cash crop, which is the way most people think of it. Secondly, it's an important drug. Now, not just a drug for people's amusement, but opium is a very excellent medicine. It was one of the most important medicines in the 19th century and is still often used today. It keeps down coughs. It's very important in diarrhea. And for people living in relatively primitive conditions, it's one of the few effective drugs that they have at their disposal. So it's used that way. It's also used recreationally. But again, there are usually strong cultural constraints on who can use it. For example, among the Akha, young people do not use it. It's supposed to be used by old men. Now, if you're an Akha, you become an old man at 44 years of age, which is fast approaching for some of us. Women don't use it. Among some of the other groups, women do. But it is something to be used and to be used with care. You do not find, in general, the image of the that you used to get in the 19th century literature of the haggard Chinese opium addict, the person who abuses it. There are people who do abuse it, just as many, many people drink alcohol here. Some people are alcoholics. Many, many people use opium there. Some people are opium addicts or opium abusers. The problem comes at a later stage. These, again, are people are using smoked opium. They are not injecting heroin or they're not smoking heroin. Now, the third function, so we've talked about a cash crop function, we've talked about a drug function. The third function is as a consumable currency. In other words, one of the problems in a traditional economy is what we call the problem of liquidity. Now, if you want to understand the problem of liquidity, get into a Philadelphia taxi cab with a $20 bill. You have the money, but the driver looks at you and says, hey, buddy, I don't carry any more than $5 in change. In other words, you can't change it, therefore you can't engage in a transaction. Now, in traditional economies, this is a greater problem. Well, all the way from southern China across northern Shan states in Burma, Thailand, and Laos, opium operates as a currency. You can walk down from southern China, have your brick of opium, cut off opium as you go, buy your rice, and it operates as the American Express traveler's checks of the region. In other words, you don't leave home without it. Now, if you're going to find a replacement for opium, which is what, in fact, you need to do if you're going to stop production, you have to meet all these different functions. You can't just take one. You have to take all three. So that's from the point of view of the growers. The first level traders are merchants who go out into the fields, go to the villages, and buy up the excess opium. This is then shipped down with various of the guerrilla armies to refineries that are mostly in the area of the Thai-Burma border, where the opium is processed into either number three, which is smoking heroin, or number four, which is white heroin. Then it's at that point that it then gets into a lowland distribution network where it's shipped out to the rest of the world. One of the points that the Congress made in one of their reports was that the opium trade has essentially two sets of victims. It has the farmers at the start of the trade who are working for very, very little and are forced to grow opium because they can't grow anything else, and the addicts at the other end who are caught in a vicious cycle of drug use, poverty, more drug use, more poverty, crime.
So if I have this straight, the Shan rebels, who you were talking about a little earlier, are into the opium trade because they use the money from that to get what they need to fight their revolution.
Yes.
And the growers do it because it's the only crop that they could possibly grow because of the transportation problems and
right.
and other problems that they have. So I guess that those are things that the U.S. government really needs to consider before figuring out any kind of policy to have. But what about the governments in that area? What for instance, are the people who grow it at any kind of legal risk? Is it legal to grow it? Do the governments have any kind of self-interest, political interest, economic interest in the growth and trade of opium?
Well, we have to be very careful to distinguish, for example, between the Thai government and the Burmese government. Let me take the Thai government instance first because it's a little easier. The Thais are very concerned about the narcotics problem. The Thais themselves have developed a major heroin problem. There are estimated to be anywhere between 250,000 and 400,000 heroin users, that's non-traditional drug users, in Thailand. The Thais are very concerned about this, and they've worked very hard to do something about it. 4 years ago when I was in Thailand last, aside from this time when I just came back, but 4 years ago, the Thais did not have an effective series of treatment programs. In 4 years, when I went back this time, they had developed effective treatment programs, and you could quite honestly say that relative to the healthcare level in Thailand, you could get as good or better treatment for heroin abuse in Bangkok as you could in the United States. So they're very concerned about that. But also the king of Thailand, quite a while ago, realized that the hill tribes who live in the hills, basically are growing opium because they can't grow anything else. And that to attempt to stop them by force from growing opium would, in fact, first of all, be a major political incursion on the possibility of their integration into Thai society, and secondly, be essentially unjust. So the King of Thailand has supported a project to provide substitute crops for the people in the hills. Similarly, the United Nations has another program of crop substitution. These are very long-term programs. It is also possible to do this in Thailand over the long term, and in fact, the only hope for a long-term solution to production in Thailand, because in fact, Thailand has the economic infrastructure that would enable people, if they do accept other crops to grow, to be able to sell them. And there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. Getting people to change traditional agricultural methods is very slow and very difficult. For a very good reason. These farmers are not stupid. If you or I come along and we give them a new crop to grow and the crop doesn't work, we go back and write a report. They starve to death. So they're not stupid. They're looking out for their own interests. But that's the situation in Thailand. In other words, the situation in Thailand is in the long run optimistic, if in the short run filled with enormous difficulties. In Burma, the situation long term looks to be disastrous, because the government does not control the areas in which the majority of the opium is being grown, and there is no possibility for their being able to control it until there is some sort of a political settlement in Burma. Now, it is in the interests of both sides to reach a political settlement, because the war there has been going on for 20 years, and neither side can win it. The Burmese government can send its army any one place it wants to go, but when it gets there, it's very much like the situation that was in parts of Vietnam. The army arrives there and everybody else leaves. The army withdraws and the guerrillas come back. Similarly, the guerrillas cannot take Rangoon, but they can control certain particular areas. 50% of the entire opium crop of Shan states is grown in an area in which there has not been any Burmese governmental presence probably for the past 15 to 20 years.
Is that because they can't find it?
Well, they can find it. They just don't dare go in there. Now, this then creates a situation where the bulk of the production is outside of any possibility of effective control. For the past 2 years, the situation has been helped by the fact that there has been a drought. But this year, the estimate is that the production in that area will be a minimum of 600 metric tons. That's the equivalent of 66,000 pounds of heroin. And that's on the way first to Europe and then eventually to the United States.
David, let me reintroduce you for our listeners just tuning in. I'm talking with David Feingold, and he's made numerous trips to Southeast Asia, studying the people who are involved in growing poppy and in opium trade. He's an anthropologist. He's the director of the Center for Opium Studies, which is part of ISHI, which is the Institute for the Study of Human Issues, and this is located in Philadelphia at the University City Science Center. He's done a lot of consulting here in the States. He's been a consultant for the House Select Committee on the Narcotics Abuse and Control. This was a committee in 1977. And we're talking about what the conditions are that lead to this enormous growth and production and trade of opium and heroin in Southeast Asia, the implications in America. Now we're going to talk a little bit about U.S. policy towards narcotics trade and whether David thinks it's been informed or misinformed. What are some of the things that our government has tried to do in order to limit the trade of the importing of heroin here in order to cut down on the drug problem and all the crime that results from it?
Historically, the United States has been committed to what's called a supply control strategy. The American government has felt something which is, in a sense, unarguable, that if we could completely cut off the supply of drugs, nobody would take them. Of course, the view that the Southeast Asians had is if there were no demand for drugs in the United States, there wouldn't be any place for the supply to go. I mean, both these statements are true and probably quite irrelevant. In attempting to operate a supply control strategy, the United States came to realize that once opium had left the field, it was impossible to stop more than 10%. The estimate now that's used by the Drug Enforcement Agency is that perhaps they stop maybe 7% of what comes out of the fields in Southeast Asia. They are quite open. They don't know. This time, as opposed to, say, 4 years ago, there was not a single American official in Thailand that I interviewed who was willing to maintain that, in fact, our policy was having any real percentage effect on the amount that was coming out. Now, given that situation, the United States has looked for ways to increase our effectiveness. This hasn't worked very well. We have tried in some areas, for example, to use herbicide spraying. This was certainly done in Mexico. It had some effect in Mexico, but it hasn't worked particularly well. One time under the Nixon administration, somebody suggested that poppy weevils, the little bugs that eat poppies, be seeded along the China-Burma border. Fortunately, someone asked the question, what do poppy weevils eat when there are no more poppies? And someone pointed out it might very well be rice, and that the Chinese might take a dim view of American poppy weevils chomping their way across the rice crop of Yunnan. So in effect, what we've said is, okay, we're going to support police activities in these countries, which are not particularly effective, and we're going to attempt to support some crop replacement, and we are going to attempt to increase the military capacities of certain governments in the hope that this will interdict the trade. One of the measures, though, of where our emphasis has been is that in the international narcotics budget, 75% goes to enforcement activities and 6% goes to crop replacement activities. So that the rhetoric is always, well, we're going to have crop replacement, we're going to get the job done that way because that's the only way people can do it. Any government official will maintain that. But when you look at where the money is spent, 75% goes to policemen who can't stop the trade, and 6% go to people working in the crop replacement area.
How much money are we talking about?
Our international narcotics budget from the State Department is about $40 million. It's a little less than that, which isn't really very much when you're talking about such a huge trade. There's additional expenditures by the Drug Enforcement Agency, and it gets very difficult to find out exactly how much we're spending abroad. But we're not stopping very much of the drugs, and we're not doing very much with our money. A couple of years ago, we gave 26 military helicopters to the Burmese government. These have never stopped a single caravan. They have also never captured a single heroin chemist. What you have is there will be reports that the Burmese have raided a refinery site, and that sounds very, very impressive. Problem is, what a refinery site is a bunch of huts and some pots in the middle of a jungle. And it doesn't become a refinery until you bring together the chemicals, the equipment, and the chemist. And that takes place for a very brief period of time. And so, in effect, there has, if you looked at before they had a program, they estimated they stopped 10%. Now, after the program, they estimate they've stopped 7%. So this doesn't seem to be a very, very effective sort of way to go about things.
So raiding a site means getting some pots and pans, basically.
Getting
right?
some pots and pans. I mean, they had a big bust in Thailand when I was there. Thais had this, and they caught 58 kilos of heroin. Well, that seems like a lot of heroin, but statistically, if you compare it to the amount that's coming out of there this year, it's insignificant.
So we're supplying these helicopters and a lot of law enforcement. If they're not getting used to effectively stop the drug trade, are they getting used for other things that we don't know about?
Well, the Burmese basically are concerned with the military aspects of conducting their warfare against these minority groups. In fact, they haven't been terribly effective at it, but this is part of what our support does. In other words, we are becoming part of the problem instead of part of the solution. What we probably should be doing is maybe acting to lend our good offices to be able to help the Burmese and the minority peoples negotiate together. But instead, what the Burmese can do is use the issue of narcotics to get us to support their military operations. It's another key thing. We should never underestimate the significance of narcotics for corruption. And let's look at it in very simple terms. If you are a Thai policeman, and you are earning maybe $6,000 a year. And let's suppose you even want to be honest. You're not being nasty, you're not being corrupt. But somebody comes along to you, comes along and says, here is $50,000 to look the other way when a shipment comes through. It takes a very strong person to say no to that. Similarly, the same problem operates here in the United States. I mean, narcotics is the major source of police corruption in a lot of these countries. Also, sometimes the corruption goes fairly high up. I mean, there are certainly enough reports of the Burmese army carrying illicit narcotics in Burmese army trucks and dealing with, in fact, the people that they're supposedly fighting.
So you're painting a picture, I think, of the United States supporting a pretty ineffective policy. Now, one of the things, you said that the Shans, the rebels who are responsible for a lot of the opium trade, invite anyone who's willing to come in and to observe the reasons why opium is so important to the cultures in that part of Southeast Asia. One of their suggestions is a plan that I think you support, which is a buyback plan. Can you explain this plan and the premises of it and who would benefit?
At several times over the past decade, the people who have been in control within Shan states have offered to sell the entire opium crop of Shan states to the United States or the United Nations. Now, the reason why they were willing to do this was twofold. First of all, they didn't really care whether they sell the crop legally or illegally. It is in their interest to sell it legally for political reasons. Now, we're talking again about the people at the first within the first two stages of the trade, not further down. And there's an important point to realize. In 1946, opium was grown legally in Shan states. It was also grown legally in India. The United Nations came along and said to the Indians, they said, you can continue to grow opium legally. And they said to the people in Shan states, you can't. But the problem is they didn't tell them what they ought to do, so they didn't starve to death. So what the Shans did was they offered to sell the entire opium crop. The United States could take it, and at the time when they originally offered this, there was a shortage of codeine. Codeine is also made from opium. So the United States could turn it into codeine, or quite honestly, they could throw it in the ocean. Now, people might say, well, why do we want to buy a whole bunch of opium just to throw it in the ocean? Well, the point is that we're buying it now, except now we're buying it on a retail level, and it's going into people's arms through needles, as opposed to having the government buying up and taking it and removing it from the market. What's more is it gives the beginning of access to people who do control the region, who then could help with the institution of the kind of economic development programs that are the only possible long-term solution to the problem. See, right now, what the effect of United States policy, and let's be very clear, it's talking about the effect, not the desires of American policy. The effect of United States policy is to run a price support program for heroin around the world. Because we only remove from the market 10%, which is just enough to keep the price up because it's illegal, but not enough to significantly interdict the amount that comes to this country. Moreover, what we do is we operate as a selective mechanism on the market because we only catch the least efficient smuggling organizations. If they're more efficient, we don't catch them. So we continually create a selective mechanism which guarantees the evolution of more and more efficient smuggling organizations.
I could see that if, for instance, legislators supported that plan, that it would be really easy to make fun of them for supporting, you know, oh, so you want the U.S. government to spend all of these taxpayers' dollars to buy all this opium, to dump it into the ocean or to burn it up. And then to getting into the absurdity of it, you know, you want to have these people grow the crops, harvest it, trade it, just so it could be destroyed. It sounds absurd in that end. How do you argue with those arguments?
All right. Well, first of all, as I said before, the United States has been committed to a supply control strategy. Once you take that as a given, you have to ask yourself, do you want an efficient supply control strategy, namely one that stops 90% or 100% or even 80% of the drugs coming in, or you want an inefficient strategy, one which never stops more than 10%. And then you look at costs. In other words, right now, we're spending a great deal of the taxpayers' money, and we're not stopping the opium. we spent
The taxpayers' money is on the enforcement and the helicopters and programs that don't work.
Right. And these programs haven't stopped the trade. There isn't anyone left in the government who's willing to maintain that they have stopped the trade. So we're spending the money now. The question is, do we want to spend the money to stop the drugs, or do we want to spend the money to not stop the drugs?
Can it be argued that if you buy all that opium, that there will secretly be growing more that you don't know about and that you're not buying, so that they can benefit from the U.S. government sales and then surreptitiously still have an enormous opiate underground?
Well, this is one of the reasons why in the initial stages of any such plan, in addition to having surveillance and checking to make sure that, in fact, that's not the case, you want to have people grow it. Someone might say, well, let's make it easy. Why don't we just pay the people not to grow it? Well, the reason that you don't want to do that until you have substitute crops available and market infrastructure and you have roads to get things to market is that you want to make sure that you have, in a sense, used up that labor. Because one of the things that we talked about at the beginning of this program is opium is a very labor-intensive crop, that the limiting factor on opium production is labor, and there isn't excess labor. So as a matter of fact, you cannot produce more than is already being produced. What happens to change the crop in it from any one year to the other has to do with weather conditions. But basically, people could sell all the opium they could produce now. It's not a product that there's not a market for.
What kind of response did you get? I know one of the things that was introduced at the House hearings on narcotics was this idea of the buyback plan. What kind of response did you get from different people?
Well, let me be very clear to differentiate when you say what kind of response did I get. There are two different aspects to this. There's one, the question of the research that went into this. This is not involved in the particular plan. The research just outlines what the situation is. The Shans transmitted a plan that Congressman Wolf introduced into consideration within the government. And as a matter of fact, one of the films we did that some of your viewers might have seen on Channel 12 was a film called Opium and the Politicians, where we filmed all the internal meetings in the White House and the meetings in Congress, which was revolving around how policy got made on this decision. The response to this was favorable in Congress and unfavorable in the executive. The executive's arguments were as follows. First of all, they said, all right, if we deal with these people who are rebels, the government of Burma will get annoyed. And that's a fair enough statement. On the other hand, we do deal with other groups that are minority groups in other parts of the world. We've had a long tradition of doing this. And no one is saying that it has to be done secretly. It can be done quite openly. And it can be said, okay, we're concerned about narcotics. You should be concerned about cutting down the fighting in your area. Why don't we have a conference and we'll all come and sit down and talk about it? That was the first point. The second point was precisely the point that you raised, what I call the small businessman from Des Moines, Iowa approach to or model of opium production, which is, my God, if we buy up the opium, people will just run out and grow more, which is very appealing, but it's only appealing when you don't know anything about the way opium agriculture works. So those were the two main arguments. The third argument is, we can't deal with these people because they're very nasty. And the equation was more or less made between someone who is a pusher in the United States and people who come from a very different sort of culture and are operating under very different sorts of economic and political conditions in the rest of the world. We don't have to approve of everything that people do in order to be able to recognize that they are a part of the world. And particularly when they say to us, we have to deal with opium. That's what we have to do in order for our people to survive. Come and help us do something else. And that's what they've said to us. And our response is, we can't talk to you.
Let me reintroduce you again, David. I'm speaking with David Feingold, who's the director of the Center for Opium Research at ISHI, which is the Institute for the Study of Human Issues, and that's located at the University City Science Center in West Philadelphia. He's made a number of trips to Southeast Asia, researching the culture of the opium-growing and trading people and the economics and politics surrounding opium growth and trade. Say we did this plan and we bought all of the opium that was produced in Southeast Asia. What would you suggest that the U.S. government do with it? Destroy it? Sell it? use it for medicinal purposes?
Basically, so far as what the U.S. government would do with it would depend upon what the needs were at the time. It's estimated that codeine needs, legitimate codeine medicinal needs worldwide, are going up 15% a year. Might be very possible to use some of it for medicinal reasons. Some of it might be put into a strategic stockpile, other parts of it destroyed. The important thing about it is not so much what the United States does with it as the fact that you are moving towards a more constructive solution. Because we have to realize something that we've said for a long time, something the United States has often said, but we haven't really realized its implications, is that the economy of illicit narcotics is a worldwide economy. For example, the Institute right now has a large-scale project with street heroin users in Germany that's being funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Now, very possibly someone might ask, well, why should Americans be worried about street junkies in Germany? Well, the reason is that, first of all, we're committed by treaty to work with the Germans on mutual problems in this area, so we have an international commitment. And secondly, as right now, one of the things our researchers have found is that heroin is virtually a glut on the market in Germany. Now, what that means is that that heroin will have to find other markets. And the other market that's obvious is the United States. Because even though the prices are higher here, the transport costs have been lower. So Europe has gotten the main flood of heroin that's been coming out of Southwest Asia, not Southeast Asia. And about 50% of it comes from Southeast Asia. So that what we have to do is begin to look at this as an international problem, not just of the question of suppressing the trade, but in terms of replacing the trade. The other key point is let's be very clear on one thing. Cutting off the supply of heroin from Southeast Asia will not do away with the heroin problem in the United States. It might improve it. It might induce some more people to go into treatment. But the drug problem in the United States is going to have to be solved with dealing with people's motivations and with the social problems that relate to drug abuse. Right now, one of the things that's happening in Washington is that treatment slots are being severely curtailed, prevention programs are being cut down, and research programs are being cut down. Now, this is coming at a time when more and more heroin is going to be coming here. We've been rather lucky for the past couple of years. The heroin problem has been down for the past couple of years.
Because of that drought you were mentioning?
Because of the drought from Southeast Asia and because of certain other factors. But it's unlikely that this is going to continue. In fact, there are some signs now that perhaps it's not continuing at all. As a matter of fact, I saw in a report from a state agency here that, in fact, the incidence of heroin use seems to be on the rise again. But we don't have a very good understanding of why it is people use certain kinds of drugs in certain kinds of ways. It's clear that the models that were common 10 years ago don't account for drug use. Just to give your listeners one simple question. Before we can account for why it is people use heroin, which is a drug that is, according to its users, highly pleasurable, we have to ask ourselves, why is it that people who are middle class, educated people who do not disbelieve the connection between cigarette smoking and cancer still continue to smoke? In other words, we need to have a model that accounts for that and accounts for it in broad-scale social terms, because you can't account for social phenomena in terms of individual psychology. That doesn't work. We also did a film this summer with street heroin users in Spanish Harlem in New York. And this will be on television probably sometime within the next year. And we looked at those people explaining how they see their lives. Now, until we have the ability to intervene in those people's lives on a large-scale basis, not just with the people who are highly motivated, but in terms of effective prevention programs and in terms of effective treatment programs and effective predictive models that will tell us, not on an individual basis, but on a social basis, where there are liable to be new problems, we're not going to be able to make a significant impact on the drug problem.
David, you mentioned that the Reagan administration is moving towards cutting back funds from drug rehabilitation programs and from research into drug trade and drug-oriented problems. But have they outlined a policy yet about dealing with the international drug trade?
Basically, the Reagan administration has not outlined anything new in terms of its policy. They've said they're against drugs. Well, you know, that's hardly surprising. There hasn't, to my knowledge, been a recent administration that's been in favor of drugs or any one of us who say we're in favor of drugs. But so far as any sort of new initiatives, they haven't been able to come up with anything, partly also because they have not filled certain key appointments. For instance, there has not been a replacement for Mattea Falco, to my knowledge, who was the head State Department person dealing with international narcotics affairs. There has not been any initiative. Now, in fairness to the Reagan administration, I don't think that there are too many people around who have a very clear vision of what it is the government should do. The one thing that's very clear is if you don't have the treatment facilities and the new heroin epidemic comes along, you're not going to be able to deal with the problem. Another thing that's very clear is if you don't do research or you only do very, very limited kinds of medical research, you're not going to be able to be prepared to deal with social phenomena.
I think some people would argue that one of the main problems of drugs in this country is not only the addictive quality of the drugs themselves, but the hands that the drugs are in terms of organized crime, you know, the people who distribute and sell the drugs. Is there a way, do you think, of dealing with that problem in the country?
There is no question that the major impact of drugs on this country has to do with the question that drugs are illegal. By this, I don't mean that they should be made legal, but the fact that they are a major illicit market. And we talked about the fact that the illicit drug trade is $64 billion. Right now, for example, the number one agricultural crop of California is marijuana. Now, you have to recognize that that is going to have a distorting effect on the entire economic and social system. In other words, again, just as Thai policemen are capable of being bribed, there is no question that American policemen are capable of being bribed because the amounts of money are so vast. You know, some of your listeners will have seen recently about – was on the television news about the Dade County homicide squad, which was considered to be one of the top homicide squads in the country, but at least according to the allegations, was completely corrupted, or large amounts of it were corrupted by drug money. Now, that's one aspect of it, the corruption aspects. In addition to that, we have what is it that is wrong with drugs? Well, one of the main things that is wrong with drugs is that if you're a heroin user, you have to contend with dirty needles, which result in hepatitis. You have to contend with the necessity to feed your habit, which often leads you into crime. And the other thing is if you are in an environment in which by the nature of what you're doing, you're engaged in a criminal activity, you're much more likely to be engaged in other criminal activities. So there's no question that that is a major, major problem. And that problem is one which the society has been very reluctant to confront. It is one that we, I think that we can't face up to at this present time. The implications of that, I think, are very difficult.
Well, do you have any suggestions of some unconventional ways of taking drugs out of the hands of organized crime?
Well, I think that there you have to very much get into what the particular drugs are that you're looking at. There's no question that certain drugs are biologically more deleterious than others, and let's compare. For example, there is no question that just in terms of total damage to the system of numbers of people, that the main problems in the United States are not the illicit drugs but the licit ones, alcohol, tobacco. Most of the abuse of tranquilizers, for example, come from people who have legitimate prescriptions for them, and they are either overprescribed by doctors or, as often happens, they are prescribed very legitimately by the doctor and someone else's friend takes Valium and then drinks liquor and You have bad problems with that. But let's leave that aside because that's often a problem of education or a problem of helping people to deal with their problems in other ways. In terms of illicit drugs, we can take a drug like cocaine. Now, cocaine is not biologically a particularly dangerous drug. probably the only thing you want to do is have some enforcement which keeps the price high, keeps it out of the hands of young people, and you probably do not, as a matter of policy, want to worry about it a great deal. Heroin is obviously a drug that you want to worry somewhat more about. It isn't as deleterious as, for instance, glue sniffing. Well, glue sniffing, we can't do anything about the supply. Anyone can go in and buy airplane glue. Again, that's education and prevention. Taking it out of the hands of organized crime involves, for some things, perhaps the consideration of certain types of maintenance programs or certain improved types of treatment programs. But again, if you're cutting back on treatment programs, you're not going to be able to provide people with alternatives. Now, this might seem extremely pessimistic, and I think as sort of the years have gone by, I've become much more pessimistic about our ability effectively to do anything about drugs within this particular social environment.
But do you think if the money was committed, if the government was willing to spend money in programs like that, that, I mean, are you suggesting ultimately that if the political climate was right and if people were receptive to the idea that there might be some kind of like government distribution of controlled distribution of drugs to keep it visible and legal?
Well, I think that there's two things. That any sort of government distribution program for heroin, and this has been considered, and it's very complex, can be looked at in two ways. On the one hand, there's the obvious question that if you had legal heroin maintenance programs, this doesn't mean heroin on the street corners out of vending machines, but if you are a registered addict, you could receive heroin, that you would create a situation where people would be getting clean drugs. They wouldn't be dying of hepatitis. You would remove it effectively from organized crime. And that's, there's a very strong argument for that. Let me also, though, present the other argument. Congressman Charlie Rangel, who represents a district in Harlem in New York, who is someone who's thought a great deal about drugs, said this about the question of heroin maintenance. He said, look, there is no question that it would save a lot of lives in terms of people who are dying from drug problems now. On the other hand, what do I say to my constituents who have been trying to keep their kids clean off drugs in an environment where heroin use is very common, addiction rates are very high? When I say to them, you're supposed to tell your kids that heroin is bad, on the other hand, the government is giving out heroin. Now, that's a difficult argument to answer, and I don't think that the issues are clear-cut on either side. The one thing that's very clear is that we have to think very carefully about alternatives, and we have to test some of them, and we have to see what the implications are. Also, there's one other point that I want to make, is that heroin maintenance, I personally think, has its uses as part of an overall comprehensive program. You do not want to take someone who has had 3 shots of 3 to 5% pure heroin in their lives and are not addicts, they're not going to be addicted from that, and give them pharmacologically pure heroin and say, oh, you had 3 shots of 3% heroin, you're an addict, and we're going to give you 95% pure stuff, and we want you to stay on it for the rest of your life. That we don't want to do. In other words, there's a place for a variety of different types of programs and approaches. The other thing that I think we have to remember is that if you get a heroin user or someone who has trouble on drugs, doesn't matter whether it's heroin or anything else, and they're troubled, and you get them off drugs, what you have is a very troubled person who's off drugs, because many people are using drugs because of other problems that are not related to their drug use. The drug use doesn't make it better, but it makes them feel better.
If the government called you up, say the president, and said, well, we're really ready to follow your recommendations, you've studied this for so many years, where do we start? What would you recommend as a first step in a comprehensive program?
Well, again, let me...
We've only got 2 minutes.
In 2 minutes to solve the world drug problem, I'm not going to say anything about treatment because there are other people who are much better able to talk to that issue. In terms of international programs, what I would say is that you have to have effective income replacement programs. You have to be able to move away from simple enforcement solutions because they're counterproductive. And third, you have to be able to explore area-specific programs. In other words, programs, you're going to have a different program that's going to work in Mexico than it's going to work in Burma. And until you begin to explore those alternatives, and until you begin to do research on those alternatives, there's going to be no possibility for an effective solution.
David, thanks very much for talking with us. It's extremely interesting research. Thank you for being here.
Thanks very much, Terry.